Hello there and welcome to the Culturefile Debate, the latest programme of which was recorded at this year's Dublin Book Festival at the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin, Dublin. The session on The Hare's Corner, an ancient notion for a contemporary benefit, was chaired by Paddy Woodworth. So what will we be talking about, Paddy?
We're going to be talking mainly inspired by this beautiful book, The Hare's Corner. Three of our panellists have a direct involvement in the book, Jane Clark, Catherine Cleary, Jane Carkle, and Colm McInamara will be coming at it from a slightly different angle. The book is all about making space for nature, essentially looking at different schemes, different pathways to creating areas where nature can flourish, even in very small scale situations. So it's organized, these schemes are all organized by Burren Bio, which many of you may know of already. It's a wonderful initiative from the Burren that essentially seeks to connect people and places and people and other people and their places. Maybe Catherine, would you start off just by very briefly explaining what each of these three schemes are, and then we will have conversations and readings from references to these schemes.
Nature flourishes and also people flourish. I think that's been my big take home from working on this book. So Burren Bio is a wonderful land use charity that was set up in 2008 in Clare. And they have these three projects which are very much about giving people the agency to do the work themselves. There's the Heritage Keeper projects, which allow people to learn online about their natural heritage or their built heritage and then take an action to engage with it and protect it. There's the Hare's Corner, which is a beautiful idea coming from farming, a farming tradition of leaving a space for the hare, for nature. And with the Hare's Corner, landowners and schools, they get the mentoring and the funding to leave an area for a pond or an orchard, a woodland or a hedgerow. So they're very practical and very beautiful ideas. And then the Farming for Nature is really about peer-to-peer learning so that farmers can tell each other about this. Because farming is a very difficult job. It's very physical. People who don't do it probably don't really understand it. So the Farming for Nature ambassadors, and there are now, I think, more than 120 of them, and they will welcome other farmers to their farms. They welcomed Jane to their farms, and she was inspired to write the poems in this beautiful book. They're three brilliant schemes run by Burren Bio, and hopefully there will be enormous funding to keep them going.
Colm, long before this book was a twinkle in anybody's eye, you actually created an entire album with the title The Hare's Corner. Tell us why, first of all, the concept appealed to you, your relationship with nature as a child, as basically an urban child spending time on Geltok's farms.
Exactly, yeah.
But maybe why The Hare's Corner in 2008?
Well, I'd been making an album in a mobile home in North Wexford. We'd moved. We were the first wave of, migrants or refugees from the Celtic Tiger. And back in 2003, and we bought an acre with a derelict cottage, and in a way that became our Hare's Corner. And the first time I heard the phrase, which would have been as Cuinne an Iúria, I'm an Irish speaker brought up in Dublin. My father was from Connemara. My mother is from, she was also an Irish speaker from County Leitrim, a rare bird. So we were raised speaking Irish, and my relationship, I suppose, with the countryside has been, a constant holiday spent with my cousins, footing turf and whatever. Cuinne an Iúria, I heard in the context of my father talking about Máirtín Ócáin, the Irish language rights activist and professor of Irish in Trinity College, and all sorts of things, a writer, thinker, philosopher. But he spoke of Cuinne an Iúria, I mean, in terms of the concept is, in agricultural terms, would be to set aside a corner of the field, because hares don't burrow, they nest, so you need kind of some undergrowth for them to shelter in. Also, there's an association with the hare, which is mythological, the shapeshifter, the voyager between worlds. But in this context, Máirtín Ócáin was talking about the Gaeltacht areas of the island of Ireland being like Cuinín Ghiria, the Hare's Corners of the field of Ireland. So it's really, it's kind of, and it was a lovely kind of concept as well to think of linguistic ecosystems. Yeah.
Yeah, lovely. Would you kind of put us in the zone for the afternoon's discussion by giving us a tune from that album? Thank you.
So this kind of is a tune from written in 2007, and it coincided with the passing of a friend of mine called Emer, so it seemed fitting to call tribute to her, make it a tribute to her, so it became Emer's Dream.
Thank you very much, Colm. That was very beautiful. Thank you. And it seems fitting in a way to move, and I love this idea of, you know, Gaeltacht as Hare's Corners also, to move to a Hare's Corner project with an Irish language title, Togri Clara, that Catherine has been working on and written about. Catherine, could you tell us about how this Hare's Corner project actually works in practice and maybe give us a little reading from
Yeah, this was the first project that I visited, and it was such a spectacular visit. It was also extremely seasick making as I was visiting Cape Clear in February, and I managed not to lose my lunch. But yeah, I arrived on the island pretty shook, and with the women of the Toga Clare project looking at me going, "That's not a big sea." So I got my sea legs, but they've created these two beautiful ponds on the island. And it's such a world of water, most of it ocean, you know, extremely exposed conditions. And there is a lake on the island, but it had been polluted with runoff. So these were the first newly created ponds. They just dug a hole and left. They didn't do anything else. They didn't plant anything. They didn't introduce any species. And all of these species arrived. They were all just waiting in place to arrive. And what's happened is an intergenerational project. These are all women on the island who have worked together to create these ponds. It's led into a community composting scheme. And they are just so thrilled with these ponds. They've become meeting places and talking points on the island in the quieter months when the tourists aren't there. So I'll just read a short extract from the end of the island, or the end of the piece. "As I leave the island on a mercifully calmer crossing, I think about the pause and stillness that a pond embodies. A feeling of calm spreads through us when we look at a pond. They give us license to stop and take a rest from our hyper-distracted lives. Their beauty is very special. On Cape Clear, the ponds are light made liquid, ovals of sky in brown fields on a winter day. This tight-knit island community has shown how simple it is to restore an aquatic system, how nature patiently waits for her chance to fix things, how small shards of water-loving plants cling on wherever they can until they find new habitat. The island, its soil, its bats, birds, insects, and streams held a memory of fresh water, and that memory rushed back to two beautiful havens high above the salty churn of the Atlantic Ocean."
Thank you very much. Jane, you mainly worked with the Farmers Ambassador Programme.
Yes.
And maybe you'd tell us about the farmer who inspired the conversation with whom inspired the poem Calf.
I will indeed, Paddy. This is a farmer, Sean O'Farrell, who farms on the Devil's Bit Mountain, the western slope down in County Tipperary. And I spent a wonderful afternoon with him. He actually inspired two of the poems in the book. One is called Caddisfly, but the one I'll read today is Calf, because I went herding with him just as it was getting dark, and he couldn't find a calf. But while we were walking, he was showing me the ponds he'd put in. He was showing me the wildflowers that were coming back. He was showing me the copse he had planted in memory of his mother. And so 6 months later, I wrote this poem. And it was because all of that stayed in my mind. So, Calf. April daylight's fading. He crosses a makeshift bridge over the stream that divides two poached fields of rushes. The sucklers raise their heads as he counts them again. There should be 10. One heifer has strayed from her mother. A heron lands at the pond, and moorhens gargle their distress, while wind bustles through the copse he planted in memory of his mother. Last spring he saw a nest there, a grass-lined oven tucked in low. Then he heard the willow warbler's falling notes. This evening, he almost misses the wandering heifer asleep under the trees. Come on, girl. He pushes her back to the herd, takes one last look, and pulls the gate behind him.
Thanks, Jane. And the other Jane Carkle, involved in the book, and this is not your first collaboration because you also collaborated with Shane Clark on Windfall. But could you talk about what you bring as a nature illustrator to a book like this? How do you conceive of your relationship with a poem like Calf, which you have illustrated beautifully in the book? How do you go about that process?
So I had a really unique perspective, I suppose, for this book. I suppose there's two perspectives to have with it. My role as a nature illustrator for a universal kind of aspect is I really feel like it's important to have this intersection of elevating the art of illustration to be really appreciated in literature rather than just being seen as something for children and maybe as an afterthought. But also I think that illustration can make books really accessible for people as well that might feel reading might be something that they're kind of paralyzed by, the see these big blocks of text. It's almost like a muscle that you need to utilize quite often to get into the art of reading. So if someone finds that really overwhelming and they're paralyzed by maybe feeling like outside of that world, I would hope that if they were even to open the book and see the illustrations, that it might invite them in to feel like they're part of that world as well. But for this book in particular, I felt I had a really unique perspective because I'm actually from the Burn myself. So many of the stories and so many of the poems especially are equally, I feel, universal, that everyone that has been to the countryside, lived in the countryside, can relate to them. But in me creating the illustrations, I was able to really delve into, go back into like a childlike state where so many of these poems are things that I've lived, and they weren't just words on the page. They're really evocative of like the smells of the farm that I experienced. And especially for this poem, Calf, that Jane just read there, I took inspiration from something that happened in my childhood where there was, to not be very eloquent, a big lump in the garden, this big grey lump out the window. And I really remember this when I was about 6 or 7, me and my sister, we were looking out the window and we were really convinced that this was like a meteor or UFO that fell from outer space. So we thought it was a lump of limestone or something like that. We left it for hours and we saw it move then. So we ran outside to see what it was, and it was a calf that had been left in the garden for shelter by the cow. So just to read these poems, it was just the most gorgeous experience that I could make my memories tactile, and also being challenged with, I suppose, portraying this very, it's like the bane of my existence as an artist, portraying this very certain colour green that I'm always trying to find and trying to capture that on the pages, and also the colour grey as well of the Burn. It was quite a challenge, but I hope it made not only my memories come to life and make them, again, relatable to everyone, but I don't know, just this book is like a time machine for me personally. It was really great.
And you did a beautiful cover for it as well. We move on maybe to another poem and another Farmers Ambassador programme, the one about hen harriers.
Yes. So I also got an opportunity to visit another farmer in County Galway in the Slievochty Mountains. Her name is Nia O'Malley, and she farms for lots of reasons with nature, but she has the hen harrier in mind. It's to try and preserve the hen harriers. And when I came away from her visit, I mean, it was a really inspiring visit to her farm, but I suppose I felt a huge sadness about the possibility. The hen harrier is so close to extinction in Ireland, and about the possibility of coming generations not getting to see this absolutely wonderful bird. So it led to quite a sad poem, but I hope that it's a way of saying, if we're not careful, there's so much we will lose. Hen harriers of Slievochty, granddaughter of my dreams, you'll never see them quarter gorse yellow slopes for voles or soar above bell heather. You'll never marvel at the grace with which they dip and lift, loose winged, redeemed. You'll never chance upon a nest in purple moor grass, then creep up close to spy 5 eggs. You'll never stand riveted while she glides bronze beyond the ruins of the Booley house, then flips to catch the meadow pipit her partner dropped in pearl grey flight. Granddaughter of my dreams, what can I do but tell you?
Thanks, Jane. And we move then back to Catherine with now a heritage keepers scheme, the one from Glendree, and a reading you have, which I think warns us against the dangers of tidying up.
Right. Only don't tell my children. yeah, the Glendree Nature Corridors project is a wonderful community building and nature restoration project where Grainne Yvonne got together with her neighbours and they decided to try and map an area of wildness, a wild way for the birds that she loves so much to be able to cross over the fields. She's built this incredibly beautiful eco-friendly house in the middle of her landholding in East Clare. And she has planted Neil McKitcher's sort of circle of native trees around, and she can name each one by memory. So it's a really magical place that she lives in. But she was very interesting about that urge to control things and keep things tidy. Our instincts to control and tame the natural world are as much about our state of mind as the status and respect that comes from dominating the nature around us. Grainne is rewilding her field because, as she says, I'm 65 and I've got 1.7 acres. There's no way I can manage it and keep it as a lawn anyway, even if I wanted to. Sometimes I've observed that after lunchtime I'd go out and I'd have quite a busy mind with something else going on, and my go-to would be to tidy what's in front of me, to put order on what doesn't need order at all. It's interesting. During one of those tidying moments, she tended to a small young tree, a blackthorn that had a skirt of dried grass around it, and I tidied it up. Inside was a little wren's nest. So no more tidying. Resist the tidying. Has her eco-grief, that physical pang, been eased by the project? I asked. The group helped me feel not alone, that I had friends in the community, she says. The fact that there was a group focused on conservation and preservation gave her a sense of strong bonds based on mutual caring. She believes that being at peace in ourselves can help us be at peace in nature.
I think that's kind of where you concluded is an underlying theme in the book, which is the relationship between helping nature, as it were, and helping ourselves. And I don't just mean in the material sense that we obviously need much more healthy biodiversity than we actually have for our own survival, but also for our psychological survival. We need a particular kind of relationship with nature. Now, an animal that's not always associated with biodiversity in Ireland forms the subject of Jane's next poem and the farmer she talked to for the Farmers Ambassador Scheme, a poem about goats.
Yes, another visit that I made was to County Leitrim, where I went to a farm there, where they're producing goat's milk, a fabulous goat's cheese, which is on sale in Carrick and Shannon and is available all around the country. The farmer there, Lisa Gifford, brought me around the farm with her granddaughter, who's about four. So I had both ends of the spectrum with me. And they told me so much about the goats. And the goats are a fascinating animal and they have an amazing history. And I suppose just to say that, you know, it's quite hard to write a poem about something so separate, to go someplace, you know, enter their lives for a few hours. But what happened was every single time the passion of the people that I met is what stimulated the poem. And I think that speaks so much to the power of working with nature and making space for nature. The goats on Leitrim Hill. All of their history is in their eyes. The horizontal pupils detected leopards and lions, gave depth perception for escape through Zagros rocks and across parched cliff tops. On Leitrim Hill, the fields are small, the soil waterlogged. A herd browses among rushes and sedge, nibbles brambles, stretches on hind legs to strip bark from willow. At night, they cluster in the galvanized shed, lick and scratch each other, one head on the flank of the next. When one dies, her companion grows listless and only lifts her light brown eyes when the sun beds down in the west.
And now, Catherine, I wonder, could you take us back to another Hare's Corner, this one appropriately called The Sanctuary?
Yeah, I was fascinated by this one. Colm's mention of being a refugee from the housing crisis. Rance T is short for Tamsin, moved to Ireland during COVID. She arrived on the ferry and Ireland went into lockdown. She'd never visited before, but she was running from what she described as a bad marriage, and she wanted to find somewhere where she would feel in tune with herself and in tune with the nature around her. And I was struck by the basic way that she's living and also the extreme luxury that she has in the nature on her land. A freezing, damp, long derelict cottage built from stones gathered from the fields sometime in the late 1700s is T's dream come true. She has a wood-fired range for heating and hot water, two radiators mounted one above the other in the bedroom, keep it warm, and the worst of the damp at bay. Storm Eowyn blew the roof off her outhouse where she had installed a compost toilet. Repairing the storm-damaged roof and reinstalling her bathroom will be a priority this year. Then there are six more solar panels to be mounted on stands on the ground to power her off-grid home. Despite basic living conditions, T has never been happier than in this place she calls the sanctuary. It is a place of her own, in the spirit of Virginia Woolf's Room of One's Own. It allows her to move to her own rhythm, which is now intrinsically linked to nature in the shape of weather, light, and seasons.
Thank you. I thought we might now move back to Jane Carkle for a moment. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, and anybody else on the panel as well, though, is the responses. Another aspect that's not credited on the cover of the book, but it's really, really striking, is the number of photographs in the book, which are taken all by people associated with Burren Bio, particularly with Brendan Dunford, who, if none of you, any one of you who has not come across his work, I recommend him because he is an inspiration in terms of working with nature on the land with active farmers. There's kind of a tension or a debate, I guess, goes on in between illustration and photography in the representation, the visual representation of nature. Bird books, for example, are very often illustrated by painters rather than by photographers for particular reasons. How do you feel about working on a book where you're illustrating and there are also photographs?
There's, I suppose, good in both things, but with my work personally, I try to hone back to, and this is what really, I suppose, inspired my journey to be an illustrator in the first place, was to keep up the mark that these things are being done by hand in a really slow way. So I really want my illustrations to come across and let people know that this is done by a human, not digitally, the old painted way. So I suppose it's this, again, interweaving of how I see the world around me. And I really, I suppose, an important thing about elevating nature and holding on to and wanting to preserving it is romanticizing it as well. So I want to romanticize my view of the world, portray that in illustrations. And then I think I was just saying to Catherine there before we sat down, these double page spreads of the photography, it can be really, it teaches me also that even though I live in the Burren, that I need to appreciate that and not just be absorbed into the banality of everyday life, that I exist among these very real things, and these things exist in real life. They're not just drawings as well. So the intersection of the two of those together, it just makes me want to go outside right now, go out into nature. It's amazing. Yeah, so I think it's a really powerful tool, actually, the two of them together. So hopefully I answered that properly. Good question.
You certainly did. And it's funny, today strikes me, it's a It's one of those days where we're all inside talking about nature, and one of the rare days when it's really, really attractive to be actually out and inside it. I was just wondering, before we go on to some final readings and music, how valuable in the great scheme of things? I mean, we're looking at COP30 on climate change at a very pessimistic and difficult moment, particularly with the absence of the United States from that agreement. So, you know, if we take that kind of focus, you can shift the focus from a pond on Cape Clear to what Lula is trying to do in Brazil, President Lula, with the Amazon rainforest. What is the relationship between acting small and the bigger actions that we need as well?
I was really struck about COP and this idea that they're going to put a fund together to protect the world's forests. At the moment, the system treats our natural world in a way that nature is worth more to us dead than alive. So we have to fund the living natural world in order to protect nature, and that has to happen at a very high level, and the system has to be changed at a very high level, and we all have a political voice that we can use in election time to make sure that our politicians care about nature. The idea that nature is worth more to us dead than alive is incredibly short-sighted. It is self-harming in the extreme to think, because we are part of nature and we are not worth more to ourselves dead than alive. We depend on it. But the nature loss we're seeing, and it has been happening so rapidly within my lifetime, really, I think maybe it was my fault, it's been death by a thousand cuts. So a thousand acts of healing, a small pond, an orchard, a community garden, a school garden, places where people feel in their bones the wellness of being in the natural environment and then feel that they love it and they want to protect it. That's how we get this to the place where we're safe again. And I think the inspiration that I got from visiting these 10 projects was immense, because often I do feel like I'm a drop in the ocean, but the ocean is made up of drops and we can all make differences, small ones and large ones, and put pressure on the system to change.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just struck by the idea of, like, you know, many of these things seem insurmountable, but I think, what often gets overlooked is how quickly consciousness can shift. And I think that's what Catherine is talking about, and how, you know, yesterday's heresy is tomorrow's orthodoxy. Stuff like in my childhood, you know, there people used to smoke on airplanes. Do you know what I mean? And how kind of things that seemed impossible and were there forever would change very quickly. So I think I was talking to somebody, a friend recently, who pointed out, and he's an audiophile, and he was pointed out the idea of, we were both appreciating the sound of a diesel engine. And he's saying, you know, that we might be actually one of the last generations to hear that sound, you know, which is very exciting. You know, in the way that, you know, like the cart horse was kind of so much of a part of everyday life, so that it's worth thinking in those terms.
Sure. The final readings from Catherine on another Heritage Keepers program called Fianua, and the piece about the value of weeding.
That's right. A little bit of tidying, but in a good way. Fianua is a wonderful centre in Ballinasloe, dealing with people, giving people respite, families respite for people with very high physical needs come to this day centre. And Caroline Graham, who was part of the Women's Shed in Ballinasloe, decided that they would put in some raised garden beds that could be tended to from a wheelchair. And they had a service user, Porig, who had tremendous value from working with that project. But Caroline also works with schools and going in and doing biodiversity projects. And something she said really stayed with me about that, what happens, conversations that happen when we're working alongside each other outdoors in that Mehel idea. It's something I do a lot with pocket forests and working with schools and communities. It's a great way to get to know somebody, but also conversations flow very easily then, maybe because we're not looking at each other face to face. So here's the piece. Caroline gives another example of the value of gardening with young people. I did two workshops during the summer for our local school. Nobody wants to hand weed anymore, but we were sitting down weeding side by side. It was a lovely day and we'd such lovely conversations. One girl who had lost her father a few years ago started to talk to Caroline. She was telling me she found it so hard in the beginning. She didn't cry because she didn't want to upset her mammy. But now she's okay. She's much better. And if she cries, and she cries if she needs to. And I was like, wow, this conversation came out of weeding. It's proper healing, she believes. In the end, we had loads weeded in the area. We need to get back to all of this.
Thanks, Catherine. And Jane, could you read us out by talking about the farmer who inspired one of the last poems in the book, Come October?
I will, yes. This farm is near Corrifin in the Burren. And so they practice winterage, where they bring the cattle up the mountain for the winter. And so I spent two half days with this family, Pat and Oliver and Carmel, and they told me about winterage and they gave me the most wonderful vocabulary as well. So I'm there listening for these words and that led to this poem. And I suppose it's a poem of hope. And I just wanted to say that that's a big theme of the book. It's mentioned so many times in Catherine's writings, and it comes out throughout, through the illustrations, through the photographs, about hope. And I think that the book is a witness to hope and a witness to the change that happens when people work together. Come October. A farmer opens the gap between two standing stones, and seven cows stroll through, bellies brushing each side. Lowland grass has turned yellow. Backlands are flooded like callows, but high on the crags the lye is dry. The foggage is sweet as it's plentiful. Rain has filled bullons to the brim, and 6-foot walls stem the wind. The sucklers follow old tracks that meander slowly uphill past thickets of blackthorn and hazel, among scarred slabs and scalps. They fan out wide, each finds her own patch to graze, and through the cold days of winter the calves they carry will thrive.
I love the fact that that poem ends on the word thrive. It's such a wonderful word. I'd just like to thank the panellists, Jane Clark, Catherine Cleary, Jane Carkle, Colin McInamara. You've been listening to the Culture File debate on RTE Lyric FM. Colin, I wonder, would you do us the favour of playing us out with Bring Us Back to Cúnamh an Chairde? Thank you.
Camilla McAfee.